and a professor in human genetics, neurology, and psychiatry. And so please join me in welcoming Dan.
Thanks. Thanks, Susan. I'm going to have a short introduction to the genetics because we want to get into the more meat of the presentation. And, you know, Susan, you know, is talking about theory, and I'd have to say that at some level, what I'm going to be telling you is really, you know, you could have, let's say, five statistical geneticists, and they'd tell you five different ways to think about, you know, p-values and multiple corrections. Some people want it very stringent, and others, you know, some people are worried about alpha or beta. You know, everybody has their politics, whether they're leaning more to the right or to the left. And at some level, you know, one has to take all of these things with a grain of salt. But what I'm going to try to do is give you a framework in which to think about this so that you can, you know, as you're reading the literature or planning studies, think about what's reasonable from a genetic standpoint. So, you know, the basic model is that genes interact with the environment during brain development, during organ development, to create the structure that is the brain. Now, when I say structure, I mean this in the most loose way. This is a dynamic structure. I'm not talking about what you can see. I'm talking about chemicals, molecules, synapses, things that are actually, you know, so when I talk about structure, I'm really talking about the organ, the brain. And so I'm not talking about just anatomy and what's connected. And so the idea here is that genes are certainly closer to the brain than they are to even cognitive function and behaviors, and certainly even probably farther away from a broad syndrome like autism or ADHD. So the idea here is that it's reasonable then to think that cerebral structure is an interesting intermediate phenotype between a kind of broad notion of cognition or autism and the gene. In other words, closer to the gene than a broad syndrome. And so imaging techniques allow you to look at cerebral structure. And one of the reasons I think Susan chose some of the talks today, and you'll see, you know, it's unusual in an imaging, you know, symposium in cognitive neuroscience, you know, to have somebody looking at dendrites. But one of the issues here is that this gets to this issue of cerebral structure in a fundamental way, and it's the kind of structure that I'm talking about as well. So the model is you have genes, something happens, and you get autism. And again, you know, to couch this in this meeting. And so something has to be happening at the level of structure and function of the brain. Okay, I hope that's clear. So the next reason I'm up here is because brain structure is highly heritable. Now, this is just one study, one slide. There are dozens of them. This is showing various heritability estimates, and there are a lot of different ways to look at heritability. But, you know, you can look at, you know, twin studies, et cetera. And I'm not going to get into that in gory detail. But there is high heritability of virtually every brain structure looked at. If you look at it morphologically, if you look at things from a less is known about function in a lot of the networks, resting state networks and all of that stuff, there's been very little work on the heritability. Typically, as geneticists, we like to understand that something's heritable before we study it. On the other hand, some of the heritability study, you don't want to, let's say, preclude research or wait till somebody spends 5 years doing twin studies of resting state connectivity before looking at it. So there's a balance there. But the key to study anything with genetic tools is that it has to be heritable. So it is. So I'm going to, you know, again, I'm going to give you a little, you know, a rubric or a framework that I kind of use to think about this. It's not the only framework, and it's not the only way that one can use imaging. But certainly one way to think about imaging genetics is we want to use imaging genetics or genetics and imaging together to identify factors that underlie variation in brain structure. So normal variation. And that has to do with understanding the brain. You could also identify genetic factors that underlie variation in brain function. And the idea there is that there's genetic variation, and I'm going to define what this genetic variation is in a second. But here, it's something called SNPs, or single nucleotide polymorphisms, and I will define it. But we want to look at some form of genetic variation, and then tie it to brain structure and or function. Now, this is all interesting, and I'm going to get to this in a second, but another way to think about imaging genetics is use the imaging as a phenotype, and a phenotype from a geneticist standpoint is anything that we can measure to identify genetic risk factors that influence an actual disease state, with the notion that the disease state is a consequence of the structure and function, and therefore is downstream and farther from the genetic susceptibility. We can also understand the neurobiological effects or mechanism of action of genes that are implicated in a disorder. And from my standpoint as a neurobiologist, the latter is the most interesting thing to me, and I think a place where the imaging is really going to play an enormous immediate role quickly. And so here you have genetic variation, and there's a and there's disease at one end, and the imaging is an endophenotype or an intermediate phenotype between genetic variation and diagnosis. And what do I mean? You probably heard the term endophenotypes, and many of you know exactly what it is. For those of you who don't, it's a phenotype that is associated with the disease, so it's observed in the disease, but also heritable. So it's seen in first-degree relatives more than in the general population. And it's something that's measurable and related to the disease. So one critical issue when trying to understand what imaging is giving you is that it provides a structural or functional phenotype data that can be treated quantitatively or qualitatively. So imaging is no different than anything else, head size, blood sugar, blood pressure. Those are quantitative traits, and you can also make a cutoff and put people into bins as well, and that would make it qualitative. So either you have a big versus small head, which would be qualitative, or something like head size that you just measured along a continuum and basically said, what's your deviation from the norm, and use that as a quantitative trait. And I'm going to get into this in a little bit in a few seconds, but I just wanted to just lay that framework that it's just another measurement. Now, of course, it's the brain, so it turns out to be important. Now, the power of any imaging genetic study depends upon several variables, including the allele frequency. So if something is incredibly rare, that's the variant that you're looking at, it's going to be extremely difficult to have power to detect an association of that in a population. So the more frequent it is, the more power you have. Sample sizes, the bigger, the more power you have, and they're usually not large. And effect size. You've heard of odds ratio. So if you have a qualitative trait, you use an odds ratio, or the relative risk, or the risk amount that a genetic variant would impart. However, for a quantitative trait, it's the percent of the variance that's explained. So two different ways of thinking about effect sizes, but generally they're small. And so one assumption, again, that I've been, I'm very repetitive, but is that effect sizes for imaging variables are larger than broad neuropsychological or behavioral phenotypes. Why do I say that? Because I've said it's intermediate, it's closer to the genetic factor, so that the relationship between the genetic susceptibility and that imaging endophenotype is going to be more tight or stronger, and therefore the risk that you're measuring is stronger. That's an assumption. So how about some terminology? So 23 pairs of chromosomes. Who doesn't know that? No, I'm just kidding. That was, yeah. Actually, yeah. Thank you, Dr. Murphy. And so, genes are organized along the chromosomes, and what's shown here is a track from the UCSC genome browser. And this is a slide that actually Jason Stein, who is a graduate student in brain mapping, gave to me. And I thought it was particularly good because it shows the chromosome laid out there in a kind of graphical representation with the short arm to the left and the long arm to the right. And what's blown up is a small region, and you can see that line is a megabase there. I don't know if this will work. Let me see. Yeah, right there is a megabase, so a million base pairs. So you can see it's a region of about 2 million base pairs that's blown up. And in there is about 10 genes. And what you see is that each of the lines there, these little lines here, are exons. Those are the coding parts of the genes. And these long areas in here that don't have a line are the introns, the non-coding parts of the gene. And then in between this gene and that gene is not a gene. We don't know what the function of that region is. So essentially you go from kind of genes that are organized on a chromosome, and this is showing two SNPs. Within a gene there are exons, introns, and single nucleotide polymorphisms. So now this has been blown up to look, if we go into one of those genes there, I think it's the PCDH, and you can see there that are listed under there are all these SNPs, and the green ones are actually ones that are in a coding region. But you can see that most of the SNPs, single nucleotide polymorphisms, are outside of the coding regions. The function of these SNPs is not known. They're just markers. It's basically they're marking the identity of a piece of chromosome. And it's highly specific. Does that make sense? And so, what is the SNP? The SNP is an alteration in the sequence. It's a sequence single nucleotide polymorphism, a variant. So that there, instead of being GC, it's now moved from C to being a T. And so we have those in our genome every 1,000 base pairs on average. It's called a polymorphism if it's present at more than 1% in the population. That's a polymorphism. That means it's kind of normal. Less than 1%, it's an arbitrary cutoff. It's not a polymorphism. It's a rare variant. It could be a mutation, but in many cases, it's just a rare variant of unknown significance. So again, we're talking common, we're talking more than 1%, and rare less, as I'll show you on the next slide. But does this kind of structural stuff make sense? So the genetic variants that we're interested in are usually these SNPs, and we usually are measuring common genetic variation, these things greater than 1%, and these would be kind of considered risk factors. They're not causal. But you could also have repeat, there are many different forms of polymorphisms in our genome. We used to think it was just the base pair changes, but we know that there are repeat polymorphisms, that is, nucleotide sequences that repeat, like CAG repeats, that are polymorphic among us. Now we know there are copy number variants, and I'm going to define that on the next slide, but those are structural chromosomal variations that we all harbor, many of which are normal and probably relatively benign, and some are pathogenic. So we can distinguish between common genetic variation and rare genetic variation. That's stuff that you see less than 1%. And when you see a rare genetic variant, it's often thought of as causal, but they don't necessarily have to be. If you have a rare genetic variant that is associated with a disease, it could be also an intermediate risk factor. So, ApoE has about a 4 to 15-fold odds ratio for Alzheimer's disease, depending on whether you're hetero or homozygous, your ethnic background, etc. That would be a common variation that's a risk factor. It's not causal. But you could have also rare mutations that do that as well, that increase your risk 3 to 5 to 10 times for the disease, but aren't totally correlated 100% with the disease. Does that make sense? So what are these copy number variants? This is a slide that Brett Abrams made, and it's basically, I show on the top a reference genome, A, B, and C. So that's the normal genome. You can have a deletion, you're missing B, that's shown below. A gain, that is you have a duplication, that's shown below that. An insertion of a new gene in that sequence. An inversion where things get flipped around. Or a segmental duplication. Segmental duplications are very important, especially evolutionarily. All of these are called copy number variants if they're greater than 1,000 base pairs. That's the definition. And we found that it used to be thought that one in 1,000 base pairs differs between us, but we now know that about 4% of our genome is copy number variant. That means that instead of having, you think you have one copy from your mom, one copy from your dad, in 4% of your genome you have two copies from one, or you're lacking a copy from another. Sometimes this can be pathogenic, especially if it is a deletion of large genes. And so it's turned, you know, when we can use a microarray, which is a technology that allows us to look at high density throughout the genome to identify these copy number variants. So it's become very cheap, very effective, and actually, just as an aside, about 5 to 10% of kids with autism are going to have a copy number variant that's pathogenic, and so this is a clinically indicated test as well as a research test. So what I'm showing here is just a slide now of, if you just start at the top, these things that sound like genetic gobbledygook, 1Q21 dupe, 3P deletion, 15Q duplication, etc. Instead of giving syndromes names now, the field is finding so many of these variants here and there that now these syndromes that are contributing to autism are just getting named by the chromosomal region where the duplication or deletion is. And one critical thing is that if you look in the fourth column, none of these things account for more than 1% of autism. Even the most recurrent, like a 15Q duplication inherited from the mother or a 22Q deletion, those are less than 1%. So you might throw your hands up in the air and say, how am I going to study this? Well, one thing you can do, and this is, I'm not going to focus on that, and it's not the usual focus of imaging genetics, but you can do what's called inverse mapping. Usually in genetics, you define a phenotype like autism, and then you look for the genes. Well, how about if we take a genotype like 15Q dupes, and then we ask, what's the phenotype? What is the phenotype that all of these cases have in common when it leads to autism? That would be an imaging genetic study that would be of great interest. In fact, one could argue that taking a syndrome like this with a major gene effect is a way of dealing with heterogeneity, because now you've started with a homogeneous sample. So maybe even with 7 or 8 or 9 subjects, you'll have enormous power because you're not dealing with a lot of variants. That's just a maybe. But that inverse mapping, I think, is going to be a very powerful way to take advantage of the copy number variant story. Another way to think about genetics as a way to make more homogeneous categories for study is the following. And Jeff Rudy from Mirella DiPreto's lab presented this, I think, this morning. But I'm just going to give you an illustration in case you missed it. This is a face task, and I'm not going to go into the task in detail, but you can see the areas in hotter colors are areas that turn on when the subjects are looking at the face, and the blue, the things that turn down. And there's no group difference. That MRI on the right is the subtraction of those, looking for a difference. There's nothing significant. However, if you stratify by having a particular genetic variant, in this case, the MET allele, whether you're the risk carriers that Pat Levitt's group defined, you can see that there's a region in the temporal lobes especially that's highly significant. And this is interesting because this is where MET is most highly expressed. In fact, if you look on the Allen Brain Atlas, MET is the most regionally enriched gene in human brain. And it's enriched in this area. So this is a way of showing you how using a simple genetic polymorphism that isn't even causal can help one look at more homogeneous effects, especially if you know where to look. And that's one of the other things that I wanted to emphasize, is that knowing where a gene's expressed is really helpful in having an a priori hypothesis. So if you want to identify genetic factors that underlie variation in brain structure, this kind of general look, you can't, it's unusual that you're going to be able to do a candidate gene study. And, most people want to look throughout the whole genome, look at all genes and find out what genetic variation leads to genetic variation, variation in the cerebral cortex volume or frontal cortex. So when one's doing a genome-wide association study with using SNPs and, let's say, a functional, a structural imaging phenotype like temporal lobe volume or caudate volume that's shown there, it's a very simple analysis. You have 3 genotypes that somebody can be in most cases. And this is just showing that in a cartoon. You can be AA, from both parents, AC or CC. And so what you basically do is you regress the genotype against some quantitative measure, which is here a caudate volume. There is showing on the right what this would look like done over the whole genome, and it's called a Manhattan plot. So on the left, in the y-axis, is the negative log of the p-value. So the higher, the better. And if it's over 7, that reaches genome-wide significance, correcting for all the 500,000 or so relatively independent, at least 10 to the minus 10 to the fifth independent tests that are going on here, because you're testing 500,000 to a million markers. So you have to correct for that. And so there's the position along the genome. Each color is a different chromosome. So you'll see these for different diseases. This is showing this for an imaging. And there's something that may be coming up, you know, to genome-wide significance on that one chromosome that's black there, but, you know, that's barely borderline. So, you know, the idea here is to find a common variant that explains the heritability of the trait, and you would look at the whole genome. Does that make sense? Did I explain that figure? You know, because I want people to be able to look at a Manhattan plot, one of these things that you're going to see, and say, huh, what am I looking at? And you're looking to make sure that the SNP is as high as it can possibly be, and the higher the better. So the problem with this is what I'm going to show you on the next slide. And this is something that, in general, when you have an expensive phenotype, like an image, people don't want to hear. So this is showing four different curves. This curve is the sample size you need with the diagnosis, something that's categorical. It could be big head, small head, autism, not autism. And it's showing that for a p-value of 10 to the minus 7, which is our threshold for genome-wide significance, and a 10% variance explained by a quantitative trait or a marker SNP, you know, so that's an enormous amount of variance for a quantitative trait. You know, you have one little SNP that's going to explain 10% of the variance. You know, so imagine, you know, most of these things are going to be 1%. So that's diagnosis. You need thousands of samples just to get up to 50% power. Not good. For a quantitative trait, even with these optimistic scenario, it's much better than the diagnosis. So that's why imaging quantitative traits are likely to be great to look at compared to the broad diagnosis of autism. But still, you need hundreds of samples to have high power to do it genome-wide and correct at 10 to the minus 7. That's what the dotted lines are. The non-dotted lines are a p-value of 0.01. Now, when would we use a p-value close to 0.01? You would use that if you're studying a single candidate gene and have a pretty narrow hypothesis, so you don't have to correct for 10 or dozens of multiple comparisons. And so if you're testing a couple brain regions and a SNP, that's a reasonable p-value. And what you can see there is that the quantitative trait, which is the darkest line, allows you to even have high power of 80% at, you know, 100 samples or even less with these assumptions. And these are very optimistic assumptions. So this is a critical thing for people to understand. So if you are going to do an imaging genetic study in autism and don't have 2,000 samples, you need to do a candidate gene study or you're underpowered. We don't have power for GWAS yet because of multiple testing of SNPs and phenotypes. And again, as I mentioned, the power is related to these things like effect size, number of samples, allele frequency. We have to find a way to limit the testing. And so candidate genes related to a few heritable brain imaging traits provide a very reasonable way to go. The problem with candidate gene studies, on the other hand, is that 80% of the genome is expressed at some time in the brain during development. So you have to have a very strong a priori. So, to select an optimal candidate gene, this would be my message. Power is not high. The a priori must be very high to permit focused, reasonable study. Genes should already have association with the disease. I think that has to be the case. Or else you're really just fishing. It can be a common risk variant or a causal major mutation. The imaging phenotype should also be plausibly related to the disease or a component of the disease. So like head size, brain asymmetry, it could be some functional network, et cetera. And the biologic a priori is even higher if gene localization or function relates clearly to a specific circuit or region, like I showed you with the MET. So if you can have a gene associated with the disease, it's expressed in a particular region, and now you're going to ask a question about that particular circuit. That's a very strong a priori. So the basic analytic framework, I have to end shortly, so I'm not going to go into it in gory detail, but for most of you who are imagers, you understand this. Since we're going to be using a quantitative trait, and and there are always variables that are related to imaging traits, sex, and age that have to be regressed out, you're going to use a logistic regression for a binary trait. I mean, you know, this is, you know, 101. I mean, you can do more fancy things. Or a multiple regression for a quantitative trait. And that's essentially, you know, the basic approach. But I would say that replication is very important. So in summary, imaging provides a quantitative phenotype that may be closer to actual genetic risk variants than behavioral or cognitive measures. Candidate gene studies should be well-powered with moderate sample sizes and assuming moderate, you know, these larger effect sizes. But statistical significance needs to be determined within the usual statistical framework that guides genetics. You need to correct for multiple comparisons, and you need to replicate if you can. So what, you know, what I'm saying is that you have genes, you know, autism spectrum disorders are 70 to 80% heritable. You have these behavioral manifestations on one end. And so what we're going to hear today a little bit about are kind of starting with concepts of cellular pathways, looking at neurons and microcircuits, which is a clear intermediate endophenotype that's very closely related to genes. And Josh Trachtenberg is going to talk about this. And then, you know, both Declan and Ashley will get into the human brain. But I think it's really critical to recognize that if you're doing cognitive neuroscience and looking at, you know, a human brain, you also have to begin to think if you're going to connect genes to circuits to behavior, you need to look at these other more detailed levels. So with that, I thank you for your attention and introduce Josh.